Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from the Treasury of American Short Stories, edited by Nancy Sullivan. The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky by Stephen Crane. 1. The great Pullman was whirling onward with such dignity of motion that a glance from the window seemed simply to prove that the plains of Texas were pouring eastward. Vast flats of green grass, dull-hued spaces of mesquite and cactus, little groups of frame houses, woods of light and tender trees, all were sweeping into the east, sweeping over the horizon, a precipice. A newly married pair had boarded this coach at San Antonio. The man's face was reddened from many days in the wind and sun, and a direct result of his new black clothes was that his brick-colored hands were constantly performing in a most conscious fashion. From time to time he looked down respectfully at his attire. He sat with a hand on each knee, like a man waiting in a barber's shop. The glances he devoted to other passengers were furtive and shy. The bride was not pretty, nor was she very young. She wore a dress of blue cashmere, with small reservations of velvet here and there, and with steel buttons abounding. She continually twisted her head to regard her puffed sleeves, very stiff, straight, and high. They embarrassed her. It was quite apparent that she had cooked, and that she expected to cook dutifully. The blushes caused by the careless scrutiny of some passengers as she entered the car were strange to see upon this plain underclass countenance, which was drawn in placid, almost emotionless lines. They were evidently very happy. "Ever been in a parlor car before?" he asked, smiling with delight. "No," she answered, "I never was. It's fine, ain't it?" "Great. And then after a while we'll go forward to the diner and get a big layout. Finest meal in the world. Charge a dollar." "Oh, do they?" cried the bride. "Charge a dollar? Why, that's too much for us, ain't it, Jack?" "Not this trip, anyhow," he answered bravely. "We're going to go the whole thing." Later he explained to her about the trains. "You see, it's 1,000 miles from one end of Texas to the other, and this train runs right across it and never stops but 4 times. He had the pride of an owner. He pointed out to her the dazzling fittings of the coach, and in truth her eyes opened wider as she contemplated the sea-green figured velvet, the shining brass, silver, and glass, the wood that gleamed as darkly brilliant as the surface of a pool of oil. At one end a bronze figure sturdily held a support for a separated chamber, and at convenient places on the ceiling were frescoes in olive and silver. To the minds of the pair, their surroundings reflected the glory of their marriage that morning in San Antonio. This was the environment of their new estate, and the man's face in particular beamed with an elation that made him appear ridiculous to the negro porter. This individual at times surveyed them from afar with an amused and superior grin. On other occasions he bullied them with skill in ways that did not make it exactly plain to them that they were being bullied. He subtly used all the manners of the most unconquerable kind of snobbery. He oppressed them, but of this oppression they had small knowledge, and they speedily forgot that infrequently a number of travelers covered them with stares of derisive enjoyment. Historically, there was supposed to be something infinitely humorous in their situation. "We are due in Yellow Sky at 3:42, he said, looking tenderly into her eyes. "Oh, are we?" she said, as if she had not been aware of it. To evince surprise at her husband's statement was part of her wifely amiability. She took from a pocket a little silver watch, and as she held it before her and stared at it with a frown of attention, the new husband's face shone. "I bought it in San Antone from a friend of mine," he told her gleefully. "It's 12:17, she said, looking up at him with a kind of shy and clumsy coquetry. A passenger, noting this play, grew excessively sardonic and winked at himself in one of the numerous mirrors. At last they went to the dining car. 2 rows of negro waiters, in glowing white suits, surveyed their entrance with the interest and also the equanimity of men who had been forewarned. The pair fell to the lot of a waiter who happened to feel pleasure in steering them through their meal. He viewed them with the manner of a fatherly pilot, his countenance radiant with benevolence. The patronage entwined with the ordinary deference was not plain to them, and yet as they returned to their coach they showed in their faces a sense of escape. To the left, miles down a long purple slope, was a little ribbon of mist where moved the keening Rio Grande. The train was approaching it at an angle, and the apex was yellow sky. Presently, it was apparent that as the distance from yellow sky grew shorter, the husband became commensurately restless. His brick-red hands were more insistent in their prominence. Occasionally, he was even rather absent-minded and far away when the bride leaned forward and addressed him. As a matter of truth, Jack Potter was beginning to find the shadow of a deed weigh upon him like a leaden slab. He, the town marshal of Yellow Sky, a man known, liked, and feared in his corner, a prominent person, had gone to San Antonio to meet a girl he believed he loved, and there, after the usual prayers, had actually induced her to marry him, without consulting Yellow Sky for any part of the transaction. He was now bringing his bride before an innocent and unsuspecting community. Of course people in Yellow Sky married as it pleased them, in accordance with a general custom, but such was Potter's thought of his duty to his friends, or of their idea of his duty, or of an unspoken form which does not control men in these matters, that he felt he was heinous. He had committed an extraordinary crime. Face to face with this girl in San Antonio, and spurred by his sharp impulse, he had gone headlong over all the social hedges. At San Antonio he was like a man hidden in the dark. A knife to sever any friendly duty, any form, was easy to his hand in that remote city. But the hour of Yellow Sky, the hour of daylight, was approaching. He knew full well that his marriage was an important thing to his town. It could only be exceeded by the burning of the new hotel. His friends could not forgive him. Frequently he had reflected on the advisability of telling them by telegraph, but a new cowardice had been upon him. He feared to do it, and now the train was hurrying him toward a scene of amazement, glee, and reproach. He glanced out of the window at the line of haze swinging slowly in toward the train. Yellow Sky had a kind of brass band, which played painfully to the delight of the populace. He laughed without heart as he thought of it. If the citizens could dream of his prospective arrival with his bride, they would parade the band at the station and escort them, amid cheers and laughing congratulations, to his adobe home. He resolved that he would use all the devices of speed and planescraft in making the journey from the station to his house. Once within that safe citadel, he could issue some sort of a vocal bulletin, and then not go among the citizens until they had time to wear off a little of their enthusiasm. The bride looked anxiously at him. "What's worrying you, Jack?" He laughed again. "I'm not worrying, girl. I'm only thinking of Yellow Sky." She flushed in comprehension. A sense of mutual guilt invaded their minds and developed a finer tenderness. They looked at each other with eyes softly aglow. But Potter often laughed the same nervous laugh. The flush upon the bride's face seemed quite permanent. The traitor to the feelings of Yellow Sky narrowly watched the speeding landscape. "We're nearly there," he said. Presently the porter came and announced the proximity of Potter's home. He held a brush in his hand, and with all his airy superiority gone, he brushed Potter's new clothes as the latter slowly turned this way and that way. Potter fumbled out a coin and gave it to the porter, as he had seen others do. It was a heavy and muscle-bound business, as that of a man shoeing his first horse. The porter took their bag, and as the train began to slow, they moved forward to the hooded platform of the car. Presently the two engines and their long string of coaches rushed into the station of Yellow Sky. "They have to take water here," said Potter, from a constricted throat and in mournful cadence, as one announcing death. Before the train stopped, his eye had swept the length of the platform, and he was glad and astonished to see there was none upon it but the station agent, who with a slightly hurried and anxious air was walking toward the water tanks. When the train had halted, the porter alighted first and placed in position a little temporary step. "Come on, girl," said Potter hoarsely. As he helped her down, they each laughed on a false note. He took the bag from the negro and bade his wife cling to his arm. As they slunk rapidly away, his hangdog glance perceived that they were unloading the two trunks, and also that the station agent, far ahead near the baggage car, had turned and was running toward him, making gestures. He laughed and groaned as he laughed when he noted the first effect of his marital bliss upon Yellow Sky. He gripped his wife's arm firmly to his side, and they fled. Behind them, the porter stood chuckling fatuously. 2. The California Express and the Southern Railway was due at Yellow Sky in 21 minutes. There were six men at the bar of the Weary Gentleman Saloon. One was a drummer who talked a great deal and rapidly. Three were Texans who did not care to talk at that time, and two were Mexican sheepherders who did not talk as a general practice in the Weary Gentleman Saloon. The barkeeper's dog lay on the boardwalk that crossed in front of the door. His head was on his paws, and he glanced drowsily here and there with the constant vigilance of a dog that is kicked on occasion. Across the sandy street were some vivid green grass plots, so wonderful in appearance, amid the sands that burned near them in a blazing sun, that they caused a doubt in the mind. They exactly resembled the grass mats used to represent lawns on the stage. At the cooler end of the railway station, a man without a coat sat in a tilted chair and smoked his pipe. The fresh-cut bank of the Rio Grande circled near the town, and there could be seen beyond it a great plum-colored plain of mesquite. Save for the busy drummer and his companions in the saloon, Yellow Sky was dozing. The newcomer leaned gracefully upon the bar and recited many tales with the confidence of a bard who has come upon a new field. And at the moment that the old man fell downstairs with the bureau in his arms, the old woman was coming up with two scuttles of coal, and of course... The drummer's tale was interrupted by a young man who suddenly appeared in the open door. He cried, "Scratchy Wilson's drunk and has turned loose with both hands." The two Mexicans at once set down their glasses and faded out of the rear entrance of the saloon. The drummer, innocent and jocular, answered, "All right, old man. Suppose he has. Come in and have a drink, anyhow." But the information had made such an obvious cleft in every skull in the room that the drummer was obliged to see its importance. All had become instantly solemn. "Say," he said, mystified, "what is this?" His three companions made the introductory gesture of eloquent speech, but the young man at the door forestalled them. "It means, my friend," he answered, as he came into the saloon, "that for the next 2 hours this town won't be a health resort." The barkeeper went to the door and locked and barred it. Reaching out of the window, he pulled in heavy wooden shutters and barred them. Immediately a solemn chapel-like gloom was upon the place. The drummer was looking from one to another. "But say," he cried, "what is this, anyhow? You don't mean there's going to be a gunfight?" "Don't know whether there'll be a fight or not," answered one man grimly, "but there'll be some shooting, some good shooting." The young man who had warned them waved his hand. "Oh, there'll be a fight fast enough if anyone wants it. Anybody can get a fight out there in the street. There's a fight just waiting." The drummer seemed to be swayed between the interest of a foreigner and a perception of personal danger. "What did you say his name was?" he asked. "Scratchy Wilson," they answered in chorus. "And will he kill anybody? What are you going to do? Does this happen often? Does he rampage around like this once a week or so? Can he break in that door?" "No, he can't break down that door," replied the barkeeper. "He's tried it 3 times. But when he comes, you'd better lay down on the floor, stranger. He's dead sure to shoot at it, and a bullet may come through." Thereafter, the drummer kept a strict eye upon the door. The time had not yet been called for him to hug the floor, but as a minor precaution, he sidled near to the wall. "Will he kill anybody?" he said again. The men laughed low and scornfully at the question. "He's out to shoot, and he's out for trouble. Don't see any good in experimenting with him." "But what do you do in a case like this? What do you do?" A man responded, "Why, he and Jack Potter." "But," in chorus, the other men interrupted, "Jack Potter's in San Antone." "Well, who is he? What's he got to do with it?" "Oh, he's the town marshal. He goes out and fights Scratchy when he gets on one of these tears." "Wow," said the drummer, mopping his brow. "Nice job he's got." The voices had toned away to mere whisperings. The drummer wished to ask further questions, which were born of an increasing anxiety and bewilderment. But when he attempted them, the men merely looked at him in irritation and motioned him to remain silent. A tense waiting hush was upon them. In the deep shadows of the room, their eyes shone as they listened for sounds from the street. One man made 3 gestures at the barkeeper, and the latter, moving like a ghost, handed him a glass and a bottle. The man poured a full glass of whiskey and set down the bottle noiselessly. He gulped the whiskey in a swallow and turned again toward the door in immovable silence. The drummer saw that the barkeeper, without a sound, had taken a Winchester from beneath the bar. Later, he saw this individual beckoning to him, so he tiptoed across the room. "You better come with me back of the bar." "No thanks," said the drummer, perspiring. "I'd rather be where I can make a break for the back door." Whereupon the man of bottles made a kindly but peremptory gesture. The drummer obeyed it, and finding himself seated on a box with his head below the level of the bar, balm was laid upon his soul at sight of various zinc and copper fittings that bore a resemblance to armor plate. The barkeeper took a seat comfortably upon an adjacent box. "You see," he whispered, "this here Scratchy Wilson is a wonder with a gun, a perfect wonder, and when he goes on the war trail, we hunt our holes naturally. He's about the last one of the old gang that used to hang out along the river here. He's a terror when he's drunk. When he's sober, he's all right, kind of simple, wouldn't hurt a fly, nicest fellow in town. But when he's drunk, whoo!" There were periods of stillness. "I wish Jack Potter was back from San Antone," said the barkeeper. "He shot Wilson up once, in the leg, and he would sail in and pull out the kinks in this thing." Presently they heard from a distance the sound of a shot, followed by three wild yowls. It instantly removed a bond from the men in the darkened saloon. There was a shuffling of feet. They looked at each other. "Here he comes," they said. 3. A man in a maroon-colored flannel shirt, which had been purchased for purposes of decoration, and made principally by some Jewish women on the east side of New York, rounded a corner and walked into the middle of the main street of Yellow Sky. In either hand the man held a long, heavy, blue-black revolver. Often he yelled, and these cries rang through a semblance of a deserted village, shrilly flying over the roofs in a volume that seemed to have no relation to the ordinary vocal strength of a man. It was as if the surrounding stillness formed the arch of a tomb over him. These cries of ferocious challenge rang against walls of silence, and his boots had red tops with gilded imprints, of the kind beloved in winter by little sledding boys on the hillsides of New England. The man's face flamed in a rage begot of whiskey. His eyes, rolling and yet keen for ambush, hunted the still doorways and windows. He walked with the creeping movement of the midnight cat. As it occurred to him, he roared menacing information. The long revolvers in his hands were as easy as straws. They were moved with an electric swiftness. The little fingers of each hand played sometimes in a musician's way. Playing from the low collar of the shirt, the cords of his neck straightened and sank as passion moved him. The only sounds were his terrible invitations. The calm adobes preserved their demeanor at the passing of this small thing in the middle of the street. There was no offer of fight, no offer of fight. The man called to the sky. There were no attractions. He bellowed and fumed and swayed his revolvers here and everywhere. The dog of the barkeeper of the weary gentleman's saloon had not appreciated the advance of events. He yet lay dozing in front of his master's door. At the sight of the dog, the man paused and raised his revolver humorously. At the sight of the man, the dog sprang up and walked diagonally away with a sullen head and growling. The man yelled and the dog broke into a gallop. As it was about to enter an alley, there was a loud noise, a whistling, and something spat the ground directly before it. The dog screamed and, wheeling in terror, galloped headlong into a new direction. Again there was a noise, a whistling, and sand was kicked viciously before it. Fear-stricken, the dog turned and flurried like an animal in a pen. The man stood laughing, his weapons at his hips. Ultimately, the man was attracted by the closed door of the weary gentleman's saloon. He went to it, and hammering with a revolver, demanded drink. The door remaining imperturbable, he picked up a bit of paper from the walk and nailed it to the framework with a knife. He then turned his back contemptuously upon this popular resort, and walking to the opposite side of the street and spinning there on his heel quickly and lithely, fired at the bit of paper. He missed it by a half inch. He swore at himself and went away. Later he comfortably fusillated the windows of his most intimate friend. The man was playing with this town. It was a toy for him. But still there was no offer of fight. The name of Jack Potter, his ancient antagonist, entered his mind, and he concluded that it would be a glad thing if he should go to Potter's house and by bombardment induce him to come out and fight. He moved in the direction of his desire, chanting Apache scalp music. When he arrived at it, Potter's house presented the same still front as had the other adobes. Taking up a strategic position, the man howled a challenge. But this house regarded him as might a great stone god. It gave no sign. After a decent wait, the man howled further challenges, mingling with them wonderful epithets. Presently there came the spectacle of a man churning himself into the deepest rage over the immobility of a house. He fumed at it as the winter wind attacks a prairie cabin in the north. To the distance there should have gone the sound of a tumult like the fighting of 200 Mexicans. As necessity bade him, he paused for breath or to reload his revolvers. 4. Potter and his bride walked sheepishly and with speed. Sometimes they laughed together shamefacedly and low. "Next corner, dear," he said finally. They put forth the efforts of a pair walking bowed against a strong wind. Potter was about to raise a finger to point the first appearance of the new home when, as they circled the corner, they came face to face with a man in a maroon-colored shirt who was feverishly pushing cartridges into a large revolver. Upon the instant, the man dropped his revolver to the ground and, like lightning, whipped another from its holster. The second weapon was aimed at the bridegroom's chest. There was a silence. Potter's mouth seemed to be merely a grave for his tongue. He exhibited an instinct to at once loosen his arm from the woman's grip, and he dropped the bag to the sand. As for the bride, her face had gone as yellow as old cloth. She was a slave to hideous rites, gazing at the apparitional snake. The two men faced each other at a distance of 3 paces. He of the revolver smiled with a new and quiet ferocity. "Tried to sneak up on me," he said. "Tried to sneak up on me." His eyes grew more baleful. As Potter made a slight movement, the man thrust his revolver venomously forward. "No, don't you do it, Jack Potter. Don't you move a finger toward a gun just yet. Don't you move an eyelash. The time has come for me to settle with you, and I'm going to do it my own way and loaf along with no interfering. So if you don't want a gun bent on you, just mind what I tell you." Potter looked at his enemy. "I ain't got a gun on me, Scratchy," he said. "Honest, I ain't." He was stiffening and steadying, but yet somewhere at the back of his mind a vision of the Pullman floated, the sea-green figured velvet, the shining brass, silver, and glass, the wood that gleamed as darkly brilliant as the surface of a pool of oil, all the glory of the marriage, the environment of the new estate. "You know I fight when it comes to fighting, Scratchy Wilson, but I ain't got a gun on me. You'll have to do all the shooting yourself." His enemy's face went livid. He stepped forward and lashed his weapon to and fro before Potter's chest. "Don't you tell me you ain't got no gun on you, you whelp. Don't tell me no lie like that. There ain't a man in Texas ever seen you without no gun. Don't take me for no kid." His eyes blazed with light and his throat worked like a pump. "I ain't taking you for no kid," answered Potter. His heels had not moved an inch backward. "I'm taking you for a damn fool. I tell you I ain't got a gun and I ain't. If you're going to shoot me up, you better begin now. You'll never get a chance like this again." So much enforced reasoning had told on Wilson's rage. He was calmer. "If you ain't got a gun, why ain't you got a gun?" he sneered. "Been to Sunday school?" "I ain't got a gun because I've just come from San Antone with my wife. I'm married," said Potter. "And if I'd thought there was going to be any galoots like you prowling around when I brought my wife home, I'd had a gun, and don't you forget it." "Married?" said Scratchy, not at all comprehending. "Yes, married. I'm married," said Potter distinctly. "Married?" said Scratchy. Seemingly for the first time, he saw the drooping, drowning woman at the other man's side. "No," he said. He was like a creature allowed a glimpse of another world. He moved a pace backward, and his arm, with the revolver, dropped to his side. "Is this the lady?" he asked. "Yes, this is the lady," answered Potter. There was another period of silence. "Well," said Wilson at last slowly, "I suppose it's all off now." "It's all off if you say so, Scratchy. You know I didn't make the trouble." Potter lifted his valise. "Well, I'll allow it's off, Jack," said Wilson. He was looking at the ground. Married! He was not a student of chivalry. It was merely that in the presence of this foreign condition he was a simple child of the earlier plains. He picked up his starboard revolver, and placing both weapons in their holsters, he went away. His feet made funnel-shaped tracks in the heavy sand. And that story was The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky by Stephen Crane from the Treasury of American Short Stories, edited by Nancy Sullivan. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from Great Short Stories of the World, selected by the editors of Reader's Digest. The Guest by Albert Camus. The schoolmaster was watching the two men climb toward him. One was on horseback, the other on foot. They had not yet tackled the abrupt rise leading to the schoolhouse built on the hillside. They were toiling onward, making slow progress in the snow, among the stones, on the vast expanse of the high deserted plateau. From time to time the horse stumbled. Without hearing anything yet, he could see the breath issuing from the horse's nostrils. One of the men, at least, knew the region. They were following the trail, although it had disappeared days ago under a layer of dirty white snow. The schoolmaster calculated that it would take them half an hour to get onto the hill. It was cold. He went back into the school to get a sweater. He crossed the empty, frigid classroom. On the blackboard, the four rivers of France, drawn with four different colored chalks, had been flowing toward their estuaries for the past 3 days. Snow had suddenly fallen in mid-October after 8 months of drought without the transition of rain, and the 20 pupils, more or less, who lived in the villages scattered over the plateau had stopped coming. With fair weather, they would return. Deru now heated only the single room that was his lodging, adjoining the classroom and giving also onto the plateau to the east. Like the class windows, his window looked to the south, too. On that side, the school was a few kilometers from the point where the plateau began to slope toward the south. In clear weather could be seen the purple mass of the mountain range where the gap opened onto the desert. Somewhat warm, Daru returned to the window from which he had first seen the two men. They were no longer visible, hence they must have tackled the rise. The sky was not so dark, for the snow had stopped falling during the night. The morning had opened with a dirty light which had scarcely become brighter as the ceiling of clouds lifted. At 2 in the afternoon it seemed as if the day were merely beginning. But still, this was better than those 3 days when the thick snow was falling amidst unbroken darkness with little gusts of winds that rattled the double door of the classroom. Then Daru had spent long hours in his room, leaving it only to go to the shed and feed the chickens or get some coal. Fortunately, the delivery truck from Tajid, the nearest village to the north, had brought his supplies 2 days before the blizzard. It would return in 48 hours. Besides, he had enough to resist a siege, for the little room was cluttered with bags of wheat that the administration left as a stock to distribute to those of his pupils whose families had suffered from the drought. Actually, they had all been victims, because they were all poor. Every day Daru would distribute a ration to the children. They had missed it, he knew, during these bad days. Possibly one of the fathers or big brothers would come this afternoon, and he could supply them with grain. It was just a matter of carrying them over to the next harvest. Now shiploads of wheat were arriving from France, and the worst was over. But it would be hard to forget that poverty, that army of ragged ghosts wandering in the sunlight, the plateaus burned to a cinder month after month, the earth shriveled up little by little, literally scorched, every stone bursting into dust under one's foot. The sheep had died then by the thousands, and even a few men here and there, sometimes without anyone's knowing. In contrast with such poverty, he who lived almost like a monk in his remote schoolhouse, nonetheless satisfied with the little he had, and, with the rough life, had felt like a lord with his whitewashed walls, his narrow couch, his unpainted shelves, his well, and his weekly provision of water and food. And suddenly the snow, without warning, without the foretaste of rain. This is the way the region was, cruel to live in, even without men, who didn't help matters either. But Daru had been born here. Everywhere else he felt exiled. He stepped out onto the terrace in front of the schoolhouse. The two men were now halfway up the slope. He recognized the horseman as Balducci, the old gendarme he had known for a long time. Balducci was holding on the end of a rope an Arab who was walking behind him with hands bound and head lowered. The gendarme waved a greeting to which Daru did not reply, lost as he was in contemplation of the Arab dressed in faded blue yabala, his feet in sandals but covered with socks of heavy raw wool, his head surmounted by a narrow short shesh. They were approaching. Balducci was holding back his horse in order not to hurt the Arab, and the group was advancing slowly. Within earshot, Balducci shouted, 1 hour to do the 3 kilometers from El Amur. Daru did not answer. Short and square in his thick sweater, he watched them climb. Not once had the Arab raised his head. Hello, said Daru when they got up onto the terrace. Come in and warm up. Balducci painfully got down from his horse without letting go to the rope. From under his bristling mustache, he smiled at the schoolmaster. His little dark eyes, deep set under a tanned forehead, and his mouth surrounded with wrinkles made him look attentive and studious. Daru took the bridle, led the horse to the shed, and came back to the 2 men who were now waiting for him in the school. He led them into his room. I'm going to heat up the classroom, he said. We'll be more comfortable there. When he entered the room again, Balducci was on the couch. He had undone the rope tying him to the Arab, who had squatted near the stove. His hands still bound, the shesh pushed back on his head, he was looking toward the window. At first Daru noticed only his huge lips, fat, smooth, almost negroid, yet his nose was straight. His eyes were dark and full of fever. The shesh revealed an obstinate forehead, and under the weathered skin, now rather discolored by the cold, the whole face had a restless and rebellious look that struck Daru when the Arab, turning his face toward him, looked him straight in the eyes. "Go into the other room," said the schoolmaster, "and I'll make you some mint tea." "Thanks," Balducci said. "What a chore! How I long for retirement!" And addressing his prisoner in Arabic, "Come on, you!" The Arab got up and slowly, holding his bound wrists in front of him, went into the classroom. With the tea, Daru brought a chair, but Balducci was already enthroned on the nearest pupil's desk, and the Arab had squatted against the teacher's platform facing the stove, which stood between the desk and the window. When he held out the glass of tea to the prisoner, Daru hesitated at the sight of his bound hands. He might perhaps be untied. "Sure," said Balducci, "that was for the trip." He started to get to his feet, but Daru, setting the glass on the floor, had knelt beside the Arab. Without saying anything, the Arab watched him with his feverish eyes. Once his hands were free, he rubbed his swollen wrists against each other, took the glass of tea, and sucked up the burning liquid in swift little sips. "Good," said Daru, "and where are you headed?" Balducci withdrew his mustache from the tea. "Here, son." "Odd pupils, and you're spending the night?" "No, I'm going back to El Amur, and you will deliver this fellow to Clinkett. He's expected at police headquarters." Balducci was looking at Daru with a friendly little smile. "What's his story?" asked the schoolmaster. "Are you pulling my leg?" "No, son, those are the orders." "The orders? I'm not." Daru hesitated, not wanting to hurt the old Corsican. "I mean, that's not my job." "What? What's the meaning of that? In wartime, people do all kinds of jobs." "Then I'll wait for the declaration of war." Balducci nodded. "Okay, but the orders exist, and they concern you, too. Things are brewing, it appears. There's talk of a forthcoming revolt. We are mobilized in a way." Daru still had his obstinate look. "Listen, son," Balducci said. "I like you, and you must understand. There's only a dozen of us at El Amur to patrol throughout the whole territory of a small department, and I must get back in a hurry. I was told to hand this guy over to you and return without delay. He couldn't be kept there. His village was beginning to stir. They wanted to take him back. You must take him to Clinkett tomorrow before the day is over. 20 kilometers shouldn't faze a husky fellow like you. After that, all will be over. You'll come back to your pupils and your comfortable life." Behind the wall, the horse could be heard snorting and pawing the earth. Daru was looking out the window. Decidedly, the weather was clearing and the light was increasing over the snowy plateau. When all the snow was melted, the sun would take over again and once more would burn the fields of stone. For days still, the unchanging sky would shed its dry light on the solitary expanse where nothing had any connection with man. "After all," he said, turning around toward Balducci, "what did he do?" And before the gendarme had opened his mouth, he asked, "Does he speak French?" "No, not a word. We had been looking for him for a month, but they were hiding him. He killed his cousin." Is he against us? I don't think so, but you can never be sure. Why did he kill? A family squabble, I think. One owe the other grain, it seems. It's not at all clear. In short, he killed his cousin with a billhook. You know, like a sheep. Kreesk! Balducci made the gesture of drawing a blade across his throat, and the Arab, his attention attracted, watched him with a sort of anxiety. Daru felt a sudden wrath against the man, against all men with their rotten spite, their tireless hates, their bloodlust. But the kettle was singing on the stove. He served Balducci more tea, hesitated, then served the Arab again, who a second time drank avidly. His raised arms made the yabala fall open, and the schoolmaster saw his thin, muscular chest. "Thanks, kid," Balducci said, "and now I'm off." He got up and went toward the Arab, taking a small rope from his pocket. "What are you doing?" Daru asked dryly. Balducci, disconcerted, showed him the rope. "Don't bother." The old gendarme hesitated. "It's up to you. Of course, you are armed." "I have my shotgun." "Where?" "In the trunk." "You ought to have it near your bed." "Why? I have nothing to fear." "You're crazy, son. If there's an uprising, no one is safe. We're all in the same boat." "I'll defend myself. I'll have time to see them coming." Balducci began to laugh, then suddenly the mustache covered the white teeth. "You'll have time? Okay. That's just what I was saying. You have always been a little cracked. That's why I like you. My son was like that." At the same time, he took out his revolver and put it on the desk. "Keep it. I don't need two weapons from here to El Amur." The revolver shone against the black paint of the table. When the gendarme turned toward him, the schoolmaster caught the smell of leather and horseflesh. "Listen, Balducci," Daru said suddenly. "Every bit of this disgusts me, and first of all, your fellow here. But I won't hand him over. Fight, yes, if I have to, but not that." The old gendarme stood in front of him and looked at him severely. "You're being a fool," he said slowly. "I don't like it either. You don't get used to putting a rope on a man even after years of it. And you're even ashamed. Yes, ashamed. But you can't let them have their way." "I won't hand him over," Daru said again. "It's an order, son, and I repeat it." "That's right. Repeat to them what I've said to you. I won't hand him over." Balducci made a visible effort to reflect. He looked at the Arab and at Daru. At last he decided. "No, I won't tell them anything. If you want to drop us, go ahead. I'll not denounce you. I have an order to deliver the prisoner, and I'm doing so. And now you'll just sign this paper for me." "There's no need. I'll not deny that you left him with me." "Don't be mean with me. I know you'll tell the truth. You're from hereabouts, and you are a man. But you must sign. That's the rule." Daru opened his drawer, took out a little square bottle of purple ink, the red wooden penholder with the sergeant major pen he used for making models of penmanship, and signed. The gendarme carefully folded the paper and put it into his wallet. Then he moved toward the door. "I'll see you off," Daru said. "No," said Balducci, "there's no use being polite. You insulted me." He looked at the Arab, motionless in the same spot, sniffed peevishly, and turned away toward the door. "Goodbye, son," he said. The door shut behind him. Balducci appeared suddenly outside the window and then disappeared. His footsteps were muffled by the snow. The horse stirred on the other side of the wall, and several chickens fluttered in fright. A moment later, Balducci reappeared outside the window, leading the horse by the bridle. He walked toward the little rise without turning around and disappeared from sight with the horse following him. A big stone could be heard bouncing down. Daru walked back toward the prisoner, who, without stirring, never took his eyes off him. "Wait," the schoolmaster said in Arabic, and went toward the bedroom. As he was going through the door, he had a second thought, went to the desk, took the revolver, and stuck it in his pocket. Then, without looking back, he went into his room. For some time he lay on his couch, watching the sky gradually close over, listening to the silence. It was this silence that had seemed painful to him during the first days here after the war. He had requested a post in the little town at the base of the foothills, separating the upper plateaus from the desert. There, rocky walls, green and black to the north, pink and lavender to the south, marked the frontier of eternal summer. He had been named to a post farther north on the plateau itself. In the beginning, the solitude and the silence had been hard for him on these wastelands peopled only by stones. Occasionally furrows suggested cultivation, but they had been dug to uncover a certain kind of stone good for building. The only plowing here was to harvest rocks. Elsewhere, a thin layer of soil accumulated in the hollows would be scraped out to enrich paltry village gardens. This is the way it was. Bare rock covered three-quarters of the region. Towns sprang up, flourished, then disappeared. Men came by, loved one another, or fought bitterly, then died. No one in this desert, neither he nor his guest, mattered. And yet outside this desert neither of them, Daru knew, could have really lived. When he got up, no noise came from the classroom. He was amazed at the unmixed joy he derived from the mere thought that the Arab might have fled and that he would be alone with no decision to make. But the prisoner was there. He had merely stretched out between the stove and the desk. With eyes open, he was staring at the ceiling. In that position, his thick lips were particularly noticeable, giving him a pouting look. "Come," said Daru. The Arab got up and followed him. In the bedroom, the schoolmaster pointed to a chair near the table under the window. The Arab sat down without taking his eyes off Daru. "Are you hungry?" "Yes," the prisoner said. Daru set the table for two. He took flour and oil, shaped a cake in a frying pan, and lighted the little stove that functioned on bottled gas. While the cake was cooking, he went out to the shed to get cheese, eggs, dates, and condensed milk. When the cake was done, he set it on the window sill to cool, heated some condensed milk diluted with water, and beat up the eggs into an omelet. In one of his motions, he knocked against the revolver stuck in his right pocket. He set the bowl down, went into the classroom, and put the revolver in his desk drawer. When he came back to the room, night was falling. He put on the light and served the Arab. "Eat," he said. The Arab took a piece of the cake, lifted it eagerly to his mouth, and stopped short. "And you?" he asked. "After you, I'll eat too." The thick lips opened slightly. The Arab hesitated, then bit into the cake determinedly. The meal over, the Arab looked at the schoolmaster. "Are you the judge?" "No, I'm simply keeping you until tomorrow." "Why do you eat with me?" "I'm hungry." The Arab fell silent. Daru got up and went out. He brought back a folding bed from the shed, set it up between the table and the stove, perpendicular to his own bed. From a large suitcase, which upright in a corner served as a shelf for papers, he took two blankets and arranged them on the camp bed. Then he stopped, felt useless, and sat down on his bed. There was nothing more to do or to get ready. He had to look at this man. He looked at him, therefore, trying to imagine his face bursting with rage. He couldn't do so. He could see nothing but the dark yet shining eyes and the animal mouth. "Why did you kill him?" he asked in a voice whose hostile tones surprised him. The Arab looked away. "He ran away. I ran after him." He raised his eyes to Daru again, and they were full of a sort of woeful interrogation. "Now what will they do to me? Are you afraid?" He stiffened, turning his eyes away. "Are you sorry?" The Arab stared at him open-mouthed. Obviously, he did not understand. Daru's annoyance was growing. At the same time, he felt awkward and self-conscious with his big body wedged between the two beds. "Lie down there," he said impatiently. "That's your bed." The Arab didn't move. He called to Daru. "Tell me." The schoolmaster looked at him. "Is a gendarme coming back tomorrow?" "I don't know." "Are you coming with us?" "I don't know. Why?" The prisoner got up and stretched out on top of the blankets, his feet toward the window. The light from the electric bulbs shone straight into his eyes, and he closed them at once. "Why?" Daru repeated, standing beside the bed. The Arab opened his eyes under the blinding light and looked at him, trying not to blink. "Come with us," he said. In the middle of the night, Daru was still not asleep. He had gone to bed after undressing completely. He generally slept naked. But when he suddenly realized that he had nothing on, he hesitated. He felt vulnerable, and the temptation came to him to put his clothes back on. Then he shrugged his shoulders. After all, he wasn't a child, and if need be, he could break his adversary in two. From his bed, he could observe him, lying on his back, still motionless, with his eyes closed under the harsh light. When Daru turned out the light, the darkness seemed to coagulate all of a sudden. Little by little, the night came back to life in the window where the starless sky was stirring gently. The schoolmaster soon made out the body lying at his feet. The Arab still did not move, but his eyes seemed open. A faint wind was prowling around the schoolhouse. Perhaps it would drive away the clouds and the sun would reappear. During the night the wind increased. The hens fluttered a little and then were silent. The Arab turned over on his side with his back to Daru, who thought he heard him moan. Then he listened for his guest's breathing, become heavier and more regular. He listened to that breath so close to him and mused without being able to go to sleep. In this room where he had been sleeping alone for a year, this presence bothered him. But it bothered him also by imposing on him a sort of brotherhood he knew well but refused to accept in the present circumstances. Men who share the same room, soldiers or prisoners, develop a strange alliance as if, having cast off their armor with their clothing, they fraternized every evening, over and above their differences, in the ancient community of dream and fatigue. But Daru shook himself. He didn't like such musings, and it was essential to sleep. A little later, however, when the Arab stirred slightly, the schoolmaster was still not asleep. When the prisoner made a second move, he stiffened on the alert. The Arab was lifting himself slowly on his arms with almost the motion of a sleepwalker. Seated upright in bed, he waited motionless without turning his head toward Daru, as if he were listening attentively. Daru did not stir. It had just occurred to him that the revolver was still in the drawer of his desk. It was better to act at once. Yet he continued to observe the prisoner, who with the same slithery motion put his feet on the ground, waited again, then began to stand up slowly. Daru was about to call out to him when the Arab began to walk, in a quite natural but extraordinarily silent way. He was heading toward the door at the end of the room that opened into the shed. He lifted the latch with precaution and went out, pushing the door behind him but without shutting it. Daru had not stirred. "He is running away," he merely thought. "Good riddance." Yet he listened attentively. The hens were not fluttering. The guest must be on the plateau. A faint sound of water reached him, and he didn't know what it was until the Arab again stood framed in the doorway, closed the door carefully, and came back to bed without a sound. Then Daru turned his back on him and fell asleep. Still later, he seemed, from the depths of his sleep, to hear furtive steps around the schoolhouse. "I'm dreaming, I'm dreaming," he repeated to himself, and he went on sleeping. When he awoke, the sky was clear, the loose window let in a cold, pure air. The Arab was asleep, hunched up under the blankets now, his mouth open, utterly relaxed. But when Daru shook him, he started dreadfully, staring at Daru with wild eyes as if he had never seen him, and such a frightened expression that the schoolmaster stepped back. "Don't be afraid, it's me. You must eat." The Arab nodded his head and said yes. Calm had returned to his face, but his expression was vacant and listless. The coffee was ready. They drank it seated together on the folding bed as they munched their pieces of the cake. Then Daru led the Arab under the shed and showed him the faucet where he washed. He went back into the room, folded the blankets in the bed, made his own bed, and put the room in order. Then he went through the classroom and out onto the terrace. The sun was already rising in the blue sky. A soft, bright light was bathing the deserted plateau. On the ridge, the snow was melting in spots. The stones were about to reappear. Crouched on the edge of the plateau, the schoolmaster looked at the deserted expanse. He thought of Balducci. He had hurt him, for he had sent him off in a way as if he didn't want to be associated with him. He could still hear the gendarme's farewell, and without knowing why, he felt strangely empty and vulnerable. At that moment, from the other side of the schoolhouse, the prisoner coughed. Daru listened to him almost despite himself, and then, furious, threw a pebble that whistled through the air before sinking into the snow. That man's stupid crime revolted him, but to hand him over was contrary to honor. Merely thinking of it made him smart with humiliation, and he cursed at one and the same time his own people who had sent him this Arab, and the Arab, too, who had dared to kill and not managed to get away. Daru got up, walked in a circle on the terrace, waited motionless, and then went back into the schoolhouse. The Arab, leaning over the cement floor of the shed, was washing his teeth with two fingers. Daru looked at him and said, "Come." He went back into the room ahead of the prisoner. He slipped a hunting jacket on over his sweater and went on walking shoes. Standing, he waited until the Arab had put on his sheish and sandals. They went into the classroom and the schoolmaster pointed to the exit, saying, "Go ahead." The fellow didn't budge. "I'm coming," said Daru. The Arab went out. Dara went back into the room and made a package of pieces of rusk, dates, and sugar. In the classroom before going out, he hesitated a second in front of his desk, then crossed the threshold and locked the door. "That's the way," he said. He started toward the east, followed by the prisoner. But a short distance from the schoolhouse, he thought he heard a slight sound behind them. He retraced his steps and examined the surroundings of the house. There was no one there. The Arab watched him without seeming to understand. "Come on," said Daru. They walked for an hour and rested beside a sharp peak of limestone. The snow was melting faster and faster, and the sun was drinking up the puddles at once, rapidly cleaning the plateau, which gradually dried and vibrated like the air itself. When they resumed walking, the ground rang under their feet. From time to time, a bird rent the space in front of them with a joyful cry. Daru breathed in deeply the fresh morning light. He felt a sort of rapture before the vast familiar expanse, now almost entirely yellow under its dome of blue sky. They walked an hour more, descending toward the south. They reached a level height made up of crumbly rocks. From there on, the plateau sloped down eastward toward a low plain where there were a few spindly trees, and to the south toward outcroppings of rock that gave the landscape a chaotic look. Daru surveyed the two directions. There was nothing but the sky on the horizon. Not a man could be seen. He turned toward the Arab, who was looking at him blankly. Daru held out the package to him. "Take it," he said. "There are dates, bread, and sugar. You can hold out for 2 days. Here are 1,000 francs, too." The Arab took the package and the money, but kept his full hands at chest level, as if he didn't know what to do with what was being given him. "Now look," the schoolmaster said as he pointed in the direction of the east. "There's the way to Klingit. You have a 2-hour walk. At Klingit you'll find the administration and the police. They are expecting you." The Arab looked toward the east, still holding the package and the money against his chest. Daru took his elbow and turned him rather roughly toward the south. At the foot of the height on which they stood could be seen a faint path. "That's the trail across the plateau. In a day's walk from here you'll find pasture lands and the first nomads. They'll take you in and shelter you according to their law." The Arab had now turned toward Daru, and a sort of panic was visible in his expression. "Listen," he said. Daru shook his head. "No, be quiet. Now I'm leaving you." He turned his back on him, took 2 long steps in the direction of the school, looked hesitantly at the motionless Arab, and started off again. For a few minutes he heard nothing but his own step resounding on the cold ground, and did not turn his head. A moment later, however, he turned around. The Arab was still there on the edge of the hill, his arms hanging now, and he was looking at the schoolmaster. Daru felt something rise in his throat, but he swore with impatience, waved vaguely, and started off again. He had already gone some distance when he again stopped and looked. There was no longer anyone on the hill. Daru hesitated. The sun was now rather high in the sky and was beginning to beat down on his head. The schoolmaster retraced his steps, at first somewhat uncertainly, then with decision. When he reached the little hill, he was bathed in sweat. He climbed it as fast as he could and stopped, out of breath, at the top. The rock fields to the south stood out sharply against the blue sky, but on the plain to the east a steamy heat was already rising. And in that slight haze, Daru, with heavy heart, made out the Arab walking slowly on the road to prison. A little later, standing before the window of the classroom, the schoolmaster was watching the clear light bathing the whole surface of the plateau, but he hardly saw it. Behind him on the blackboard, among the winding French rivers, sprawled the clumsily chalked-up words he had just read. "You handed over our brother. You will pay for this." Daru looked at the sky, the plateau, and beyond, the invisible land stretching all the way to the sea. In this vast landscape he had loved so much, he was alone. And that story was The Guest by Albert Camus from The Great Short Stories of the World, selected by the editors of Reader's Digest. And now from Pushcart Prize, Volume 37 from the year 2013, edited by Bill Henderson. Resurrection by Laura Rodley. Never again will a tsunami come silently out of the unknown. It will be tracked by a radar, so there will be just enough time to run. Never again will people walk unaided by the spirits of those drowned by the tsunami. "Smell this rose for me," they will say. dipping their head closer as if for a kiss. Taste this smoked eel for me, as they lean by your cheek to hear you chew. Touch this, they will say, willing you to lean towards the magnolia bud, ripe with the wish to burst. But not yet the pink halo erupts. Carry this, they ask, carry this load of bamboo tied with rope upon my back. Take this load to my mother. Tell her I got lost upon the way, and now in deep waters of the ocean I have not forgotten. Untie the bundle for her, her hands knotted with age. Lay the bamboo in a neat pile for her to use as she wishes. She had so admired the way I cut the stalks without braising their ends. It takes a clean, sharp knife. Tell her I'm calling her name. Speak it for me. Mama-san, my little Rebecca, speak it for me so she can dry her tears. And for my brother, pull his hands away from the damp soil. Tell him I am not here. He will never find my bones. But you have found me, O kind stranger, walking beside you, and you will tell him what I say. I beg you, and I am not ashamed of that. And take these slippers for my sister, red with embroidered flowers, beaded. They were for her birthday. Tell her I have not forgotten. I was just looking for a way back in to bring them to her. A way back in. And that was Resurrection by Laura Rodley from Pushcart Prize, Volume 37, from the year 2013, edited by Bill Henderson. And that's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On Demand Podcasts. You can also listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me, and bye for now.